Running a business keeps you on your toes. Wouldn't it be great if your internet connection could keep up? Introducing Business Class Fiber from Vox. It's super fast, reliable, and highly cost-effective. You get unlimited calls to all SA destinations, and it's scalable. So no matter the size of your business, you've still got room to grow. Get connected with Business Class Fiber from Vox and see what super fast internet really means. For more information, visit vox.co.za.
Thank you for downloading the Tech Central podcast. My name is Duncan McLeod. I'm at the offices today of 365 in Midrand for what I think is going to be a very interesting discussion on legislation around cybercrime and cybersecurity. But before you yawn and flip across to another podcast, take a listen to this conversation, because I met my guest today, Corinne Vermaak, a couple of weeks ago to develop a framework for this discussion today. And despite talking about lawmaking, it's a really interesting and really important topic that is going to affect all organizations in South Africa. First, though, before we get into the meat of it, Corinne, welcome to the podcast. Tell me a bit about yourself. You've got quite an interesting background.
Thank you, Duncan. I am a techno-legal specialist by background. After completing my LLB and battling through the challenges of articles and the likes of your steps into the discipline as a legal practitioner, I soon realized that I probably wasted all my family investors' money, being my dad, as I had no interest in the law whatsoever. The only thing I found remotely interesting was contracting from a technology perspective. And that developed a very keen interest on my side to understand and speak both legal being effectively a language. The law is a language that we learn, but so is technology. And if you can marry the two up in a good way, it makes you very productive in the industry.
I'm sure.
And on a postgrad level, I made systems and understanding network technologies the base of my studies, and further to that, I completed an LLM in information technology law. So that puts a very specific focus on the law elements with regards to technology. And initially, I specialized in service level management and structuring both the mathematical and the technical writing into contracts from a service level perspective. And I found myself working in the networks industry mainly, and I have been for the better part of 10 years.
Great. Well, you're now director of the 365 Academy, which is a division or a subsidiary of 365?
Correct.
Tell me a bit about 365 and about the Academy.
So 365 as a company started out 8 years ago, formed by two technologists, network engineers, uncategorically being the best in their trade. And whoever you speak to in the industry will confirm that the brains and the starting engine behind 365 are probably the best network engineers you can put your hands on in South Africa and probably in Africa. Having said that, around them developed amazing capabilities around specialized network services, networking audits, mm-hmm. and in recent days, all of the very technical product elements that the network environment is seeing. So network virtualization, cloud services and the likes of those. All of this supported by a core focus of technology driven and technology and engineering focus. So that is what 365 is in a nutshell. It's a very strong, in their core DNA, a technology and engineering firm that looks after specializing in network services, if I can only name one of the disciplines.
Right. So you came here from Vodacom Business, where you were involved in developing a lot of legal documents.
Yeah.
and you've come across here, you're now director of the 365 Academy. What is that specifically?
So the 365 Academy is a brainchild between myself and one of the directors that formulated to the early start of this year, in which there are quite a few technology academies that brings training into IT, for the lack of a broader spectrum industry term. What we wanted to do is we wanted very specific niche courses into the ICT environment, with a focus on some of my specialities, but also formulating education drives from a technology point of view. So again, there's a lot of technology IP that are vendor specific. Mm. So whatever, and in our industry we call it TIN, whatever TIN we use, that TIN vendor prescribes certain methodologies of study. And those have never, in essence, been collated and put together to share from an IP point of view. And then obviously the techno-legal matters that, that comes with me, some of the Poppy expertise, service level management expertise, and the cybercrime.
Okay. Well, it's cybercrime legislation, or the development of cybercrime legislation, that we're going to talk about today. So let's jump straight into it. And you really are an expert in South Africa on this field. You have contributed opinions, feedback on the development of this bill. But please give us an overview of the development. First of all, what is the full title of the bill? What was its genesis? Who came up with the idea? Who developed it? How does it differ from other similar legislation that we've seen introduced elsewhere in the world?
Okay. So in South Africa, the development of the Cybercrime Bill, and you asking around the name is very interesting, because it's now on the last gazetted draft, has developed in quite a monstrosity of a name. It is the Cybercrime and Security Bill.
Well, that's not too bad. It's not nearly as bad as the RICA Act, which I still can't remember the full version of.
So it initially was just this cyber, but it's now got an element of security to it, because it does develop quite a few administrative functions, and I'll get to those later. But in essence, it's been a late addition to our legislation portfolio. We've had very light and previous attempts on governing and defining crimes around the cyber environment, and previous terms used was computerized or computer-aided crimes, effectively playing on the fact that by use of something electronic, because the definitions are quite wide, you can perpetrate a crime. In that, we've been party, so we've showed, as South Africa, we've showed intent to put this kind of legislation in place as far back as 17 years.
Oh, wow.
So we were signatories to the EU Convention as well as the directive in 2001. There was a directive in 2013, which we also joined. And then in the old Electronic Communications and Transactions Act in 2002, the legislator had a first stab at putting something on the table. Mm. This obviously was not sufficient, and it took quite a bit of time. Towards 2014, we saw some active, involved mechanisms being put in place and intent by the legislators as well as the prosecuting bodies to now structure this legislation. And bodies were formed. So the Cybercrime Hub and some of the legislative administrative functions were formed. Policy frameworks were put in place. Advisory councils were inaugurated in 2013. And all of these mechanisms have been a vessel to start creating this piece of legislation. Obviously, globally, there is a lot of model legislation. So all of the countries, parties, and signatories to these treaties have adopted legislation. Mm-hmm. So there's globally guidance on what this legislation should govern, what it shouldn't govern, what are offenses, what are penalties, how the industry should contribute towards this. And this is effectively the background in how we came to this. In the first draft, all of the industries impacted, including the ICT industry, was asked in public commentary to specifically comment from their point of view, similar to the financial industry, and all of these towers were asked to comment. I was lucky enough to form part of a group that commented on the bill on behalf of the electronic communications and, of the communication arm of the industries.
Okay.
And that saw final comments towards November of last year. And then we saw the published bill in January 2017, which we were all elated about, because at least most legislation is not faulty, but it's in a way has got a lot of commentary against it as a first stab, and that's why we have mechanisms to amend this. But from a personal point of view, I do think this is a first step in the right direction. At least now South Africa has joined. Even the African Union has had model legislation around this since early 2000s. Having said that, South Africa now has a bill formulated to govern this as a topic. Mm-hmm. And I think that is the first big step towards fighting cybercrime and legislating around it.
Okay. So, I mean, these things always go through lengthy processes. I've not in this specific case, but I've certainly written about the development of legislation in the past, and usually there's a green paper. Sometimes they skip the green paper and go straight to a white paper. Then you have the bill, then you have legislation. Has a similar process been followed in the development of this?
Correct.
And what's still involved in terms of this bill? Is there further industry solicitation that gets sought, or is it simply sent to the president for a signature at this point?
Yes, so at the moment, there definitely was a, specifically the National Integrated ICT Policy Green Paper. That was in January 2014. And that not only intended to give some guidance into this process, but it also highlighted some of the frustrations and commentary that the ICT industry had with the like some of the model legislation that has been put on the table. So certainly the process to a similar degree as other legislation development was followed on this. At the moment, we think from a legal fraternity point of view, as well as the ICT industry, that this will now be presented for signatory. And we're actually hoping on that rather than to delay the release of the bill based on further commentary. We have seen that the legislator has taken to some of the changes requested in commentary. And if I can give a short example,
sure.
On a previous draft, there was quite extensive regulations regarding copyright. And copyright, obviously, then specifically within the cyber environment or within the computer environment, that was met with massive, massive, massive commentary from the industry. And for multiple reasons, very validated. Copyright law has been around for much longer than computers. And thus, we have developed case law on that, and even applied within the cyberspace. It dates back to the early 80s, where the Chinese reverse-engineered Sega games. So international and locally, the copyright mechanisms were felt to be redundant, effectively. And on the latest draft that we've now seen in 2017, the copyright regulations has been removed. So the legislator and writers towards the bill is definitely taking cognizance of the commentary, the public commentary received on the legislation.
Okay.
And we're quite positive about that.
So, I mean, this goes through all the normal processes. The state law advisors look over it and they check it for constitutionality and all this sort of thing. So there's still a whole series of steps that have to be gone through before this is signed into law. When do you actually think this legislation is likely to be introduced officially?
So how long is the string? in terms of the processes, so there's, in this specific piece of legislation, some of the elements were done differently than its predecessors. For instance, some of the regulatory bodies is already in existence. So there is not at the moment a scramble to put some of these bodies in place. Mm. Yes, there are at length administrative processes described in this piece of legislation that everybody will have to now flesh out the details of that, but certainly the bodies, the cybercrime hub, and these intelligence agencies has been established. And therefore, to answer your question, we as the industry are hoping that we'll see it signed into legislation towards the second half of this year.
Okay. So tell us a bit more about the bill and what it contains. Firstly, what is the intention of the bill, and what is the industry's perception of that intention?
So, again, with global models being followed, there is a big need to create offences. Now, the legal purists might differ from me on this, as any of these crimes has historically had common law mechanisms under which they can be prosecuted. Mm-hmm. However, the prosecution mechanisms were problematic. To give you a light example, hacking in the true sense of the word, if you have to draw a parallel to that, would be housebreaking. Mm-hmm. So breaking and entering, and it would have to be prosecuted using those kind of mechanisms, mm-hmm. and showing the same intent, unlawfulness, access, and all of those elements. So in this piece of legislation, it creates specific offences surrounding the use of a computer in perpetrating. So that's the first intent of the law, is to now structure these offences and to give the legal disciplines the mechanisms in which they can prosecute in a cleaner manner, if I can call it that, on these offences. It also then creates an understanding of the harmful use of computers. And I call it harmful because even in the preamble of the law, it talks about this harmful use. So to use electronic equipment, computers, mobile telephones in a harmful manner is now criminalized. But then the law, and I think this is overseen in commentary a lot, but it also creates a lot of structures for crime fighting. So this is really important because cybercrime historically, and with the recent burst in development that we've seen over the last 3 years, has not been supported by the hierarchical law enforcement structures. It cannot work. We cannot prosecute these criminal networks, and that's effectively what it is. It's a network of highly skilled criminals that attack us in ways that we actually cannot defend. And that effectively is the intent of the bill. And again, to my previous comment, it is in a lot of cases highly overlooked that this law actually puts these structures in place and also puts obligations on the industry, as well as information sharing mechanisms in which we can, in a more lateral manner, fight the cybercrime instead of leveraging some of our old, you know, crime fighting mechanisms that we have to us.
To what extent, though, is, I mean, we, I think a common criticism in South Africa is that we love to pass new legislation without thinking about how we capacitate, how we actually enforce that legislation. Are we not running the risk here of introducing a fancy new cybersecurity bill and actually not, and then asking a police force, for example, that is simply not skilled in this area to try and enforce action against computer criminals?
Absolutely true. And it is the most lacking skill across the industry.
And it's not just South Africa, is it?
No. It's globally. Mm. It's globally the knowledge and the skills surrounding cybercrime, cyber defense, cybersecurity is lacking in a very, very big manner. And yes, however, this legislation doesn't put the whole burden on the police. Mm. It splits the burden and the administrative functions amongst a multitude of bodies, mm-hmm. including this focused hub that is created as a focus enforcement group to collate the information received from the industry and then action it. So two, without actioning on any of this information received, yeah. it's null and void. And in essence, the South African police forces are not in the true sense of the South African police forces skilled to manage this. However, I do think people underestimate the involvement of some of the specialized units within SAP with regards to cybercrime. Mm. I do think they have played a big role in trying to fight this and assisting especially the financial industries in trying to get to a root cause. Mm. And the bill intends to do it. I'll unpack it a little bit later, but the bill intends to have the industries and the role players support this crime fighting to a very, very, very large degree. And that is where I say it has to become lateral. Mm. Across the industry, everybody's going to have to play their role to prevent, detect, and fight cybercrime.
Mm. So I want to get into some of that detail. But I mean, as a good question to ask at this point will be, as a company, I mean, obviously this affects, I would imagine, the ICT industry more than others, and I would imagine it affects internet service providers particularly, and probably financial services institutions as well. But as an ordinary company, let's say I run a business in retail, do I need to worry about this bill at all? Is there anything in this bill I actually need to know about? Is there anything that I need to be concerned about? Perhaps we could talk about it from a non-IT company as a first point, and then talk about it what it means for, say, an internet service provider.
So absolutely. I think the key in this is that people, and it's been surveyed across a multitude of industries, have got very limited knowledge of what cybercrime is in the essence of it, mm-hmm. and what a commodity data has become. And data being a very umbrella term, I'm going to use the example of your retailer. A retailer in many cases owns large quantities of information on buyers, credit card information, even stock control, imports, and all of that. Now, in the hands of a skilled cyber criminal, all of that is commodity in its own right. So a functioning email address can fetch up to $3 in, I don't like to use the term, but for recognition in the dark web. So if you have access to 1,000 validated email addresses, that is a commodity, and thus a target of crime. And actually, the non-IT companies we have found in some of the recent research are targeted at a higher level because their defense mechanisms are lower. Because of that opinion that I don't have information that they might want. They can't directly steal out of my bank account. Mm. So I then am probably not a target to cybercrime. That is the furthest from the truth. If you have any data, access to data, and store data, you are a criminal target. And that becomes what we call a target sphere. So the cyber criminals get access to that, they copy it, you might have been hacked without it even knowing, and they will sell that database to the next buyer, or they will exploit it and use it to in social engineering campaigns where they now are aware. I'm going to use an example. You have bought from the Edcon Group and there's now a database available to this criminal organization, and they do spear phishing attempts where they mail you with some of your account detail from Etcon, and it looks valid. So on the face, with the low levels of awareness that we see in society, somebody opens the mail, see, oh, this is my Etcon account. I see there's an issue. Maybe I should do this, or there's a arrears amount. I need to pay this, or they've had a change in banking details. And we've seen this on a multitude of levels. So certainly, to answer your question, everybody should be aware of this. And I do think awareness is key, that people understand. It's very scary. I was a keynote speaker at an event recently, and out of the 100 delegates, when I asked about the cybercrime bill, all in IT-related industries, only 4 people put their hand up to say that they're aware of the bill, that it will take effect within, worst-case scenario, the next 12 months, and that it's going to have an impact on their organizations. The rest of the delegates at the event was unaware, and that is part of the battle that we have to fight.
Yeah. There was a good example, I think about a month or two ago now, around Steakinicor losing customer data, and we see reports of this all the time, not so much in this country, I suspect because the companies aren't required to disclose it, but certainly out of the States, it's almost a weekly occurrence where we see major breaches of information. The Yahoo attack has been a very high-profile one in recent years. With this new bill, will there be any liability on companies if they lose customer information through a cyber attack? Would Steakinicor, for example, have been liable under this proposed legislation in some way for not safeguarding customer information?
As with most pieces of legislation, they work together. So if you combine this piece of legislation as well as the POPI Act, you will definitely have an element of liability, even in the absence of this legislation, in my previous opinion, or in my personal opinion, you would definitely be held liable, and a general reasonable test will apply whether you reasonably protected the data. However, the prosecution is a problem in that, because in a lot of industries, there isn't clean standards for the protection as yet. We are in early days with regards to enforcing POPI. So all of large organizations have been audited. They've got POPI champions. People have been trained. People are aware. But we're still in early days. We don't know what the courts are going to do with this. We don't know how harsh enforcement is going to be and how big the load will be on the regulator. Similar in this case, we don't know how a lot of this will be interpreted, but under the general standing of the law, I do think that reasonability will apply and companies will be held by industry standards with regards to protecting data. And industry standards is very wide and governed globally. So that puts increased pressure on companies to understand what their security portfolio services and risks are towards protecting data. And specifically, so you're talking about POPI kind of data leaking. But definitely, if you can quantify those damages, I think we will soon see a lot of people taking on these companies for being negligent with the information and protecting it.
Okay. So I have to ask this question. We've been hearing a lot ever since Edward Snowden, I guess, probably even before him, about nation-state overreach in cyber affairs, if I can call it that, with the NSA and GCHQ and broad surveillance of citizens. Is there any evidence of overreach in this bill? Is there any risk that we're going to be creating a surveillance state of any sort in the South African legislation that you've seen?
As the bill stands at the moment, I, in my personal opinion, don't think we have a lot of mechanisms that can constitute overreach. There are a clause that raises concern with me, and that's an information sharing clause in, mm-hmm. in Chapter 10 that effectively is at the moment still not undefined, but it puts an obligation on cabinet members to create regulations around detecting and working towards detection, prevention, investigation, and mitigation of cybercrime. Now, as the bill stands at the moment, that those regulations haven't been defined.
Okay.
So I would like to see, once cabinet members go into the detail of those regulations, how onerous they become. Mm-hmm. And how it pans out. But as it stands at the moment, I don't think there's overreach.
Okay, so the bill, in your view, is generally quite sensible.
Yeah.
Okay, well, that's good to hear. you do believe, though, that sections of the bill can be seen as counterproductive. Why is that?
So first, I think this kind of commentary comes out in all types of legislation. Mm-hmm. But there certainly are a few mechanisms within this bill which we will hold our breath until interpreted in case law or by the regulator. And the reason why I say that is the lack of knowledge and skills within the prosecution arm of the South African legislators puts us in a tricky position, because as a true purist, if this piece of legislation is enforced on the word, it will certainly, for certain clauses, cause it to be counterproductive. But if sensibility is applied, and in many cases I like to use the word common sense, then surely I think the bill can do a lot for cybercrime fighting. And I'm going to do a few examples where the first thing is the bill creates an offence for effectively tampering. So how it reads is the unlawful and intentional altering of data, computer messages, stored information. So, absolutely, we should not allow for people to tamper with data. However, in the last 12 months, in the cybersecurity, so now I'm talking on the defense side, we have seen one of the topics being artificial intelligence, as well as deception technologies. Now, to use an example, one of the deception technologies that I'm very familiar with is a network perimeter device that effectively scrams information, the metadata. So if I call it information, the metadata behind a attack. So if they see an attack towards the network focused on a specific set of information, I'm going to use the example of mobile information, this device will scramble the metadata on that set of data. Now, that is, in the true sense of the word, altering that information. And this device will do it automatically, thus there will be no consent. Mm. And it will represent it back to the attacker or the botnet, whether it's a botnet or an actual attacker, as irrelevant information then, because they've got a set of information with the wrong metadata. For instance, this phone is presented as a iPhone, but it's actually an Android.
It's like a honeypot to lure them in and away from the main prize.
Exactly. Mm. And we're seeing a lot of that as artificial intelligence, deception, and moving target defenses is the only way that we will effectively change the paradigm around just defending the castle. So it has not served us well to just defend, build a wall, dig a trench, build a wall, and have the castle. The attacks on the castle remain. Mm. But as soon as you start switching the castle around and having three different castles, not knowing which one is the residential one, it becomes tricky and delays attacks. And that's exactly what these kind of technologies do. But in the true sense of the word, as it's drafted at the moment, that is tampering with data. Mm-hmm. And these kind of deception technologies can be seen as unlawful.
So does there need to be an exception actually written into the legislation to cater for that? Or does that simply need to be removed?
No, I think personally we need to take a first round at it from a court's perspective. Mm. So put it in front of the powers to be and see whether sanity prevails. Because I do think with the right amount of supporting facts that anybody applying themselves will be able to see, but this was done in good faith and was done as a defense and not intentionally malicious. Mm. So I do think that the legislation is very clear on these kind of offenses being intentionally malicious or intentionally unwrongful. And these kind of defenses will not be seen, but it is very wide and it talks about the intentional changing of data. And this kind of technology does intentionally change data. And again, I have to say, it will be without consent. So iPhone will never give the consent that you present their phone as an Android. We've got to understand that from a technology point of view. So will a lot of data owners not agree that you change the metadata on their data. Yet, this is a first line of defense for networks. Mm. This is one of the examples. One of the other examples that I combine with the information sharing that I mentioned earlier is some of the obligations that has been put on industry and some of the penalties relating to this. So two of the industries clearly defined within the legislation is effectively the electronic communication industry and then the financial industry. And in that, the bill is very clear for these industries to report incidents that come under their attention. So it has served, especially the financial industry, quite well. Mm-hmm. And if I can use from a personal experience point of view, if I land on my banking page, my bank always gives me a sort of a heads up on the newest phishing mechanism and what the look and feel of the email is. And I find that to be quite helpful. Now, that information will now, under legislation, have to be reported back up into the cybersecurity hub. And this information will then be mapped and there'll be some intelligence applied in managing different kinds of threats. But this as an obligation, obviously, puts a further obligation on these industries for beefing up, for the lack of a better word, their security disciplines. Now, in the financial industry, focus on security has been around for quite a while. So too in the electronic communications industry. However, the investment ratios are very different because your investment ratio towards defending your network and your data depends on what your risk aptitude is or your risk tolerance. Having said that, some industries or some ICT players might invest a lot of money in cyber defense and the next one might elect not to do it. And that becomes problematic once you start looking at the clause relating to information sharing. So again, as I previously mentioned, information sharing at the moment is still open-ended. Effectively, it reads to be defined by cabinet members. However, I think those definitions will come quite soon after the bill, if not possibly in draft already, of how should the industry share this information. Now, that I think might be very, very counterproductive, purely because of companies' investment. So the one company spends upward of 40% of their IT budget on cyber defense, and they are forced to take that information that in many cases is a market distinguisher. So the fact that their clients are secure on their network is a selling tool, and that's why they've invested in these technologies. Where the next company only spends around 4% of their IT budget on security, and they get the benefit of this information sharing. And we've seen this globally. In the UK, the legislation was drafted in a similar manner in which these industries had to share all of their findings. Mm. So, for instance, if you had perimeter security in place and you were tracking malicious IPs, you had to share those malicious IPs and they were collated and shared with the rest of the industry. But if you were the only role player in the whole industry doing that, everybody else gets the benefit of your costly CapEx expenditure.
Yeah, so if you're a security company, information security company that sells this stuff for a living, you're not going to want to hand this over to the guy down the road who doesn't necessarily have that data, because it's a competitive advantage to you.
Exactly. And forcing companies to share this into a data room sharing scenario in the UK was very counterproductive. Some of the companies even went as far as switching off some of their security defenses and saying, then we're not doing it anymore. And this is not how we're going to win the fight. Mm. So by taking away certain people's competitive edge towards their customer products and then making them despondent is not the way forward. So in the UK, they had a second stab to the legislation and they changed it to say that these industry leaders need to keep record, like you would tax records. You need to keep records of these findings for inspection and audit by the regulator. So I would like to see, once the regulations come out, based on the information sharing obligations, how they are set out and how onerous it is. Because outside of it being onerous on the industries like financial and ICT, I expected to have some terms from some of the other industries, like the apparel retailers you mentioned earlier. These guys, similarly to the banks, sit on a magnitude of information that is highly sensitive and a great sphere for cyber attacks. Mm. And thus, could under interpretation be required to have a similar information sharing role?
Are you hoping that will still be changed before this becomes legislation, or do you think that should be part of some sort of future amendment to the Act?
I don't think necessarily it needs to be changed without having detail of what the regulations are. Mm-hmm. So I can't say that I think it needs to be changed in this draft, certainly not. I do think that information sharing or information collecting, maybe for the lack of a better word, is a mechanism in which we can learn how to defend against cybercrime. However, I think there needs to be a clever mechanism by the legislator in fleshing out these regulations still lacking in how they will address it so that it does not follow the route of the UK legislation and thus become counterproductive.
And I suppose the advantage that we're doing this so late compared to the rest of the world is that we can learn from those guys.
Yes.
I want to come back a bit to the cyber hub that you mentioned. Has it already been created, even though the legislation is not in place yet?
Yes. So the cyber hub was established in October 2015 already.
What is it doing at the moment? Has it actually got people working for it?
Yes.
What are they doing at the moment?
So they collate information out of the industry. They have established some hands into the industry to start into a multitude of industry to help put focus on trending cybercrime, because certain countries are focused on for certain different reasons. Mm. So from a South African defense point of view, we need to understand why we are under attack. Mm. Are we under attack for IP? Are we under attack for personal data? What are the trends of this attack? And they have been doing a lot of work and research in developing these kind of trends, seeing what it is, helping to guide towards the legislation, as well as doing education drives with regards to cybercrime awareness.
Okay. And post the implementation of this legislation, what is that cyber hub actually going to do?
So the cybercrime hub potentially will have a 24-hour reporting mechanism. So they will have like a monitoring hub, mm-hmm. In which these industries that are now obligated by legislation to report these incidents can report it, and that information will then be collected
is that
for
useful?
Further research.
Is it useful to do that?
I do think it is, because cybercrime tends to come in waves, and these waves have a certain distinct trend. So there's a big phishing wave that comes out, attacked from a certain territory into the country. And if one player picks it up, you know, the awareness can be created that this is the next wave coming. And then as soon as everybody stops reacting on these phishing waves, then the cyber criminals reorganizes and they launch the next launch of attacks. And then it's a magnitude of DDoS attacks.
So do other countries have similar cybercrime hubs
yes.
that the governments have created? Okay.
Yes.
And the idea then is, I guess, that these international cybercrime hubs will liaise with each other in fighting international cybercrime. Because this is something that doesn't respect borders at all.
No. No. So some of the discussion points at Davos and some of these multinational congresses is in the long term to do information sharing up to a centralized information hub so that we become preventative instead of reactive, because defending cybercrime is very reactive still by nature. And even on as elementary as a antivirus, it still depends on already identified signatures. So we are constantly defending versus being proactive and predicting these trends and trying to defend in a better manner.
Okay. Just lastly on the cybercrime hub, is it going to have any law enforcement capacity at all?
So the bill is quite extensive in terms of the different role players, and I think this session might be slightly short to unpack all the enforcement. It will definitely play a role. However, there are other committees, including the South African Defence Force and the South African Police, that plays a very large role. And I expect to see, with the help of the Cybercrime Hub, that the National Prosecuting Authority will also join forces and create a specialized prosecution team.
Okay.
Again, as this goes back to skill and knowledge. So without the knowledge to unpack the technical components of these attacks, you'll be hard pressed to litigate on them.
Okay. The message in short, though, I think, is that companies have not been paying enough attention to this bill. It's coming soon, probably sometime in the second half of this year, and it's time to, like Poppy has affected everyone, this is going to affect everyone as well, and it's time to get up to speed on it.
Absolutely. First step is to read it.
That's always a good
and
place to
start. And I say that tongue in cheek.
Well, maybe a good place to start is to listen to this podcast. And
it doesn't read well, easily. It's quite an extensive piece of legislation. It's got a lot of administration sections in it and might bore the general reader. But definitely, your company needs to start focusing on what the impact is and what the strategy is for this going forward. Mm. Certain of the clauses also have an audit obligation on companies that hold critical information, and critical information is a topic by itself, as if it is strategic, can bring the economy to a halt, naming but a few of the sub-qualifiers for this critical information infrastructure. You are forced by this legislation to audit.
Does it affect, do they have different requirements of larger companies as opposed to SMEs, for example, or SMEs just as affected by this?
No, so everybody is affected by it. However, the bill does set out to ring fence people that have access to critical information, and that in an infrastructure-related way, and
right.
the protection around that. So it does definitely put a higher obligation of these. So we're talking around the ESCOM. If the telemetry of ESCOM is hacked and brought down, it can have the national grid fail. So that is critical information infrastructure.
I know there's been a lot of controversy about legislation in some countries with, I know in Australia it was particularly contentious, but not only Australia, where internet service providers are required under legislation to store customer data, browsing history, for example, for a period of sometimes several years. Is there anything in this bill that requires ISPs to store personally identifiable information about their customers' browsing habits, for example?
No.
There's nothing like that in this legislation.
Well, no.
I suppose that's good news for privacy advocates.
I think with the focus around other privacy legislation in South Africa, I think this was mainly to focus around the offences in computerised crime.
Okay, great. Excellent. Corinne, it's been a fascinating discussion. Thank you so much for joining us on the Tech Central podcast. I hope this is going to be the first of a series of podcasts we will record in the coming months on everything to do with cybercrime and IT law more broadly. And I'm sure our listeners have found this discussion very useful. So thank you for imparting your knowledge today.
Thank you very much for your time.